Professor Carlson. The course name is New York Civil Practice. The date is November 12th. It's a room 230 at 6 o'clock.
Thank you. We have more than enough time to cover chapter 9, and hopefully we'll start chapter 11 involving motion practice. And chapter 11 is nothing more than a generic motion practice chapter. It's not directed toward any specific motion, just introduces us broadly to the subject of motion. It's a nice, easy chapter. As I mentioned last time, chapter 9, hard chapter, okay? Difficult chapter. If you don't read this chapter really carefully and then read the Article 14, Article 14A, Article 16 of the CPLR, you could wind up very confused, okay? So, my goal tonight is to eliminate that confusion and lay out the material in a way that simplifies it, okay? So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to repeat the definitions that we covered last time. Not everybody was here last time. Make sure we're all starting at the same point. Let's get our definitions down for contribution. Let's get our basic definitions down for indemnification. And we're going to take a look at the provision of the general obligations law governing settlements. Okay. Once we have those down, and I'll cover them quickly, we did cover them last time, I'll cover them quickly, we're going to explore, okay, the ground rules for contribution and indemnification, and to demystify the process, okay, we are going to take a look first at the plaintiff, okay, and then we are going to explore the rights of the defendants. By separating out the strands, hopefully it will make a lot more sense. Okay? We begin with our definitions for contribution and indemnification. For those that were here last time, not a big deal. I'm going to give the same definitions. You can listen again for those that weren't. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. So first, what is contribution? I'm going to offer you a definition. It's, right, remember what we said last time, it's a group of us, right, contributing to pay a judgment. In the simplest way. Right? We think of contribution, this is a very easy mnemonic device. It's a group of us getting together to kick in our share or contribute toward a judgment. Now I'll give you the technical legal definition, but you know, as a practical matter, the legal definition is not so different. Right? It's a group of defendants, co-defendants, all of whom are contributing a share. Their equitable proportionate share as determined by a jury toward the judgment. So let's get our legal definition down, but that's a simple way for us to remember. Contribution. Sharing of a loss by each of several persons who may have been responsible for an injury. Okay, or who are actually found responsible. Under the doctrine of contribution, responsibility for a loss is apportioned among two or more tortfeasors who are required to pay their proportionate share of the loss. Does not require an agreement, arises automatically under the law. Right? Okay. What is indemnification? What is indemnity? I'm going to begin by mentioning something that we didn't cover last time. We often think, lawyers often talk about when they're drafting agreements, right? Hold harmless provisions. Right? Hold harmless provisions. Indemnification and hold harmless are two terms which are often joined together in the same sentence. You are going to indemnify and hold me harmless. Right? Those of you who have seen who do contract work at the companies that you work for may have seen contracts that have these provisions. What is the concept? Right? What's the concept? The concept is the party who is agreeing to indemnify and hold harmless another party is basically saying or agreeing in some substance, I will compensate you for a loss if you are sued. If you are sued as a result of the subject matter of our agreement, I will compensate you and hold you harmless. Okay? I will pay any judgment which is rendered against you. I will pay your legal fees, etc. Okay? That's a way of remembering. Sometimes those of us who do contract work are familiar with these kinds of provisions. They're very commonplace. Let's throw in a definition. But basically, if you're doing that kind of work, you're going to find this easy to remember. Okay? It's holding somebody harmless. It's agreeing to compensate them for any loss that they suffer. In toto, the entire loss, right, as a result of a lawsuit which arises from the subject matter of the agreement. Okay, that's something I didn't mention last time in last time's class. I've been thinking about it some more as I was reading through these cases again. So again, what is indemnity? Indemnification or an obligation to indemnify arises out of a contract, okay, express or implied under the common law, right? Because we see in tonight's cases there are instances where an obligation to indemnify arises out of the common law. And the concept is to protect against the loss which has or may occur, right, either directly or by reimbursement. Okay? And as I said in the last class, what the heck does that mean? I'm going to indemnify you directly or by reimbursement. It means nothing more than if B has an obligation to indemnify C, right? B obligated to indemnify C, B can either pay the claim directly to A, okay, or if C pays it, B can reimburse C. That's common sense. Common sense. And we want to keep it at a common sense level to get through this because there are lots of rules and nuances in this section. That's all it means. If B is going to indemnify C, B can either do it directly by paying A directly on behalf of C, or reimburse C if C pays A. Easy stuff. Okay? Last time we took a look at something called implied indemnity, and we used some of the examples which appear directly in the cases. Right? When is there an implied obligation to indemnify? The example we use is in the situation of a master-servant. Right? In the situation of a master-servant. The servant or employee causes some harm which the master, the employer, is responsible for. Right? If the employer pays the claim, the employer can seek indemnification from employee. And that's an implied obligation. We don't need a written agreement as between employer and employee to enforce that indemnification claim. It arises under the law. It's an implied obligation or duty to indemnify. Okay? Now, we have these basic definitions. I know I'm hitting you with them kind of quickly, but that's okay. We use these as the bases for our discussion. Then we talk about General Obligation Law 15-108 B and C. Okay? And they appear on page 480. And I said we should take a look at that before we read the cases because it involves the effect of settlements. Okay? And that some of these cases, we're going to discuss the effects of settlements before they actually exposed us to this section of the General Obligation Law, so that we should cover this first. Okay? And what does this section say? Well, A talks about how a settlement affects the amount. A settlement between B defendant and the plaintiff affects the amount that C must pay. Okay? That's what letter A governs. We did not cover that. I began to read it, and then I realized, you know what? This is too impenetrable. Let's just cover the examples in the book, and we'll get around to talking about subsection A and the man, especially the last case in this chapter. We'll go through all of the arithmetic. You'll see exactly how A works. B and C, though, we did cover. Right? Recall that we did cover B and C. And B and C basically provide as follows. I'm going to flip to B and C myself. I know the rule, but I'll just read it out loud. A release which is given by the injured person to a tortfeasor relieves the tortfeasor from liability to any other person for contribution. Okay? pause a moment. What does that mean? It means that if B finds his or her way out of the case, right, they are not liable for contribution. They are not liable for contribution to any other party. Okay? What is the next section of this section of the General Obligations Law say? A tortfeasor who has obtained his own release from liability is not entitled to contribution. What does that mean? If B settles with A, B cannot get contribution from the other parties. Okay? Easy. Let's summarize. A settling party cannot get contribution from the other parties. A settling party is not liable for contribution from the other parties. And we see that in the cases, right? In the last case in this chapter, we see the Manville Corporation, right, settling for a fraction of what it was arguably, right, supposed to pay. It can neither get contribution from any other party or obtain contribution from any other party. Same thing. It can't seek contribution. It's not liable for contribution. It's out of the case. In theory, there's one exception. There's always an exception, right? And the one exception which we mentioned, which I think the next to last case covers, and you have to read that case carefully, right? The next to last case in this chapter says what? It gives us another exception which we have to engraft onto this to make things more confusing. It says, yes, the general obligation law provides that a settling tortfeasor cannot obtain contribution from C or D. But it says that the general obligation law does not mean and does not foreclose B from seeking indemnification from C. Okay? What does that mean? If B has a contractual right to indemnification, or a right under the law for indemnification, it can shift its loss to another party. Right? Either contractual or provided by law. That's what the next to last case stands for. I'm telling you in advance. Okay? So it's a little bit confusing. Basically, it comes down to a couple of basic principles. If you settle out of the case, right, under the general obligation law, you don't get contribution, and nobody else can get it from you. But you can still get indemnification. And somebody else can get indemnification from you. Okay? That's what that next to last case stands for. We'll cover that case. That's a case where it wasn't awarded, if you remember. See, I'll tell you what the facts are just briefly. That's the case where we had a machine manufacturer, and the machine manufacturer puts a machine into commerce, and it doesn't have protective devices on it. And it tries to shift that responsibility to the buyer. What winds up happening is that the machine manufacturer said, made the argument, you know what, if you put these guards on this thing, I wouldn't have been sued, okay? So, yeah, I settled with the plaintiff, but I want to get back from you my full settlement, okay? That is allowed under the law. In that particular case, it wasn't allowed, and there were public policy reasons. But the basic concept, the idea that somebody could settle with the plaintiff and seek full indemnification is allowed, right? You can settle out and get in full indemnification for the amount that you paid. This provision in the general obligation law doesn't bar that. Okay? So, we have definitions, we understand how the GOL works. Now, to make things worse for you, now we are going to explore still more nuances, right, under the law. And the reason for that is because we have to have all of this stuff down, all of these different principles down. Then the cases are a piece of cake. But that's what makes this area confusing, is that it is subject to a lot of little rules. All right. Now, we have our basic rule set. To demystify this, we are going to do something strange. We are going to look at the plaintiff's rights. Okay, the plaintiff's rights. Now that is an odd concept, where we're talking about contribution and indemnification. Contribution and indemnification, of course, that relates to rights among co-defendants, B, C, and D. What on earth, right? What on earth are we talking about when we talk about the plaintiff's rights? All right. Here are the principles that we are concerned with when we are in this area of contribution, okay, as it relates to the plaintiff. First, our plaintiff A may recover from any of these defendants, from any of them, the full amount of economic loss from each wrongdoer. Okay? These are rights that the parties have among each other. Okay, we're going to put aside our definitions for a moment. Okay? So that's our first thing we have to write down, is that A, if A wins in this context, right, A can recover the full amount of a claim for economic loss from B, C, or D. Now, what is economic loss in this context? Okay? This, by the way, is the personal injury context. What is economic loss in the personal injury context? It is things like medical expenses. It is things like loss of revenue. I was out of work because of an injury. I lost a certain amount of salary. That is economic loss. Okay? So it doesn't matter. B, C, or D are all liable for the full amount of the economic loss. Remember now, we're only examining A's rights. Okay? What else? What other rights does A have? Okay, next. Under CPLR 1601, okay, under CPLR 1601, which applies to personal injury actions involving two or more tortfeasors who are found to be jointly liable, okay, 1601 applies to two or more tortfeasors who are found to be jointly liable. Okay. A party, a defendant party, okay, whose equitable share of responsibility for the judgment is 50% or less, right, 50% or less, is only liable for their share of plaintiff's non-economic loss. Before I explain this, what is non-economic? Non-economic loss in a personal injury context relates to things like pain and suffering, mental anguish, loss of consortium. Okay, that's where the big numbers come in, right? That's where the big numbers come in. That depends. The big numbers could come in the other from economic loss too. This is where some significant numbers can come in a personal injury context. Remember, we are examining this from the plaintiff's perspective. So CPLR 1601, right, which is entitled Limited Liability of Persons Who Are Jointly Liable. This section floats around this chapter too, and can potentially confuse you. Our author talks about it a little bit. Okay? So what's happening? We have jointly liable tortfeasors, right? Among this group, they're going to be seeking contribution and indemnification. We find out that under Article 16, the plaintiff, right, can only recover the pro rata share of the defendant's liability in this context, where an individual defendant is responsible for 50% or less of the plaintiff's injury. It's kind of a mouthful. Do you guys follow that? We have a rule, right? So what winds up happening is if it's 30, 60, 10, right? B, who's responsible for 30, doesn't have to pay more than 30 for the non-economic loss. D, responsible for 10, doesn't have to pay more than 10. Okay? What would have happened? What if A tries to enforce its judgment against C, who was allocated or is responsible for 60%? Okay? A could recover 100% of this amount from C, but would be limited to recovering 30 and 10 from B and D. Okay, we are talking about non-economic loss here. What would happen if A recovered 100% from C? What would happen? C, of course, would try and recover the excess that it paid from B and D. Right? That's where the contribution comes in, right? Think about it, right? Let's take a step back. I want to pause here because this is really the key to contribution, right? Contribution only kicks in, guys, right, if you pay more than your share, right? That's the only reason it kicks in. If you pay your share, right? If you pay your share, you're not liable for contribution. You don't get contribution. Right? You pay your share. You're out. You're out. Forget settlement. You paid your 10%. Can anybody get another nickel out of you? No. You paid your share. Plaintiff can't get any more money out of you. You paid 10%. Can the other parties get contribution from you? No. Right? The only time somebody gets contribution is when they pay more than their share. Right? When they pay more than their share, then they're looking to the other parties to kick in and reimburse them. Okay? It is key to understanding contribution that somebody has overpaid, in effect. Somebody paid more than their share, and they want to get it back. That's what contribution is all about. There is no mystery to contribution. The problem under the law, right, if you understand this, you will totally understand the underpinnings of this concept of contribution, right? The underpinnings of the law allow A, in some instances, to get 100% from one guy. That force law has paid the whole amount, even though their applicable share is less than 100%. And that force law has a right to seek contribution from his or her co-defendants. That's contribution. Okay? So if you understood that the first go-around in torts, you got it. If you didn't understand it till now, you got it. It's not that hard, but that's the idea. Somebody's overpaid, and somebody else is going to have to chip in. They're going to have to contribute their share and reimburse the party who overpaid. And when we say overpaid, we mean paid more than their proportionate share as determined by the jury. The reason that happens is because the law allows the plaintiff, in some instances, to recover the whole amount from one party. Got it? Okay. That's it in a nutshell. If we stop here, you would basically be armed with enough information to be able to discuss this intelligently. I mean, it's not that much more to it. Let's talk about the rules that govern contribution as among the defendants. Okay? We know what the plaintiff's rights are, and we know what, because the plaintiff has this right, in some instances, to recover the whole amount, we have to devise, our system has to devise a way to allow the party that pays the whole amount, or more than its share, to recover that amount from the excess from the other co-defendants. Okay? And the system is built in this manner. So now let's talk about B, C, and D, the defendants. You know what? I need to give you one more principle before we move on. Okay? I said that A is the plaintiff, is limited in what it can recover from B, where B is found to owe 50% or less, right? Okay? We said that that rule appears in section 1601. The exceptions to this rule are in 1602. So you want to note that, okay? This rule limiting what A can recover from B, which appears in 1601, all of the exceptions are in 1602, and there are a lot of exceptions. Okay? That's why this area of contribution, in theory, you know, you would think, well, okay, this contribution should not be such a big issue. It is a big issue because there are tons of exceptions, and they appear in section 1602. Okay, I'm not going to go through all of the exceptions. This will take way too long. Okay. All right. Now, let's talk about the defendants and their respective rights. Okay. Okay. Under CPLR 1402, a party cannot be compelled to pay more than their allocable proportionate share. Okay. Among the defendants, what does that mean? Okay, 1402. In the notes to 1402, and I understand, first of all, you got a lot to read. You got to read this chapter. It's not so easy. You also got to look at the CPLR. In the notes to 1402, there is an example of what I'm talking about. I'm going to sketch it out for you. Okay, as among co-defendants, B, right, assume C paid everything, B cannot be compelled to pay more than its proportionate share. What does that mean? What does that mean? Concretely, what does that mean? Let's use the example from the notes to section 1402. It's a nice, easy example. A gets a judgment for $12,000. Each of these tortfeasors, they are jointly liable to pay a third. Okay? That is what the jury found. However, this case, and remember, this is one of these things that you kind of got to, you know, follow me on this. This case is going to fall inside an exception under 1602. That means that any one of these parties can be liable for the full amount. Okay? That's what we're going to assume to make this work. Under 1601, in theory, B, C, and D could not be compelled to pay more than their one-third share. We're going to assume that it falls inside an exception under 1602. So that any one of these parties, our assumption going in is that any one of these parties can be compelled to pay the full amount to the plaintiff. Everybody okay with this? Okay? Here's what 1402 says. 1402 says, pretend B pays the full 12K. Got it? B pays the full 12K. What is the most that C can be compelled to pay in contribution back to B? What is the most? The most is C's proportionate share on a contribution claim. C's proportionate share is 1/3 of 12 is 4K. Easy, right? Okay? The book, to illustrate this principle, right, to illustrate this principle, puts another twist on this, on the facts. Okay? You ready? The book says, pretend for a moment that these were the facts. B paid the full 12K, right? They were each 1/3 liable. D is insolvent. It's got zero assets, can't pay a nickel. The book says, I'm talking about the CPLR, not the textbook. The CPLR says, the most C can be liable for is its pro rata share for K. That's the rule. The book puts this twist on the facts to demonstrate to us what can happen, right? Somebody got stuck paying more than their proportionate share because the plaintiff had a right to recover the full amount from any of the defendants. So in the end, B winds up paying 8K, C winds up paying its proportionate share because that's the most that B can get out of C, and D is insolvent. We assume that D is either out of business or files for bankruptcy and doesn't pay. Got it? Okay, so as among the defendants, an individual defendant can never get more than the proportionate share out of the co-defendants. We good with this idea? We move on. What is the next principle you need to know? And again, I'm just covering things that are in the text. Okay? I'm trying to make sense of what's in the text for you. I'm not really trying to go outside it. Believe it or not, this is all in here. How are contribution claims raised? CPLR 1403. They are raised in a separate pleading. Meaning, we talked about this last time, meaning you wait for the case to be over. So we talked about the statute of limitations very briefly. And doesn't it seem like this is an incredibly complicated area? Like, doesn't it seem like, wow, you never had a clue that this was so difficult? For most of us who are not in the personal injury area, right? Like, I'm not in the personal injury area. I never have to deal with this, right? Because, and we're going to talk about the reason why. There's another rule, right? There's a rule of why that is. But I never deal with this. So I never have to deal with any of the nuances of these rules. It really is complicated. I've taught this number of times. I have to reread and reread and reread this every single time. It is not easy. I want to make one footnote to our discussion before I go on, and I'm going to cover how contribution claims are raised. But the reason why you don't see difficult questions relating to contribution, law professors would like to ask difficult questions relating to contribution on exams, right? Because it's easy to write the question and they're hard to answer. But you probably won't see anything remotely like this on the bar exam because people get too caught up in the arithmetic. And you can wind up squandering enormous amounts of time trying to puzzle through the numbers. And at the end of the day, what difference does it make? You have so much more stuff to be tested on. Why give you a math question in the guise of a law question, right? So you're not going to see these tricky questions on the bar exam, where people play around with the numbers and you have to remember all these rules, it becomes impossible. Okay, and I'm not going to ask you them because I think it's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. But I do want to at least expose you to it so you know, yeah, this is kind of a complicated area. I'm in the commercial area. I'm glad I don't have to do this. If I'm in the personal injury area, you will eventually know this like the back of your hand. It's not hard. It's just that if you don't do it all the time, it's tricky. It seems very foreign. So how are contribution claims raised? CPLR Section 1403 tells us. And that's easy. Cause of action for contribution can be asserted in a separate action with the summons and complaint, or by cross-claim in an answer, by counterclaim, or by third-party claim in a pending action. Okay, so basically anywhere, in any pleading. Right? That's how you can raise a claim for contribution. You can raise it in any form. And the CPLR section is 1403. Next. This is a tricky little rule. Assume, for the moment, that B has a right to indemnification from C. Okay. B, and this is sort of a common sense rule that you have to think about it, B cannot be subject to a claim for contribution from C. So if B has a right to indemnification from C, C can't get contribution out of B. And that sort of makes sense. It's sort of a tautology, but you sort of have to think about it. Okay, and I note that because the book says that. And it's true, you have to think about it for a second. If B has a contractual or implied right to indemnification, it's a total loss shifting. Right? C pays everything owed to B. C doesn't then get a right to get some of it back through a contribution claim. It sort of wipes out C's contribution claim against B. Okay, you can take that down if you want to, it's okay. Contribution is another principle. Contribution is not available when damages are solely economic harm due to breach of contract. Our author notes this, and it's true. That's why in one of the cases. That's why you don't have this in the commercial context. This arises where you have claims made against multiple tort cases. Doesn't arise in claims for economic harm involving breach of contract. You don't have cross claims for contribution. Right? You don't have cross claims for contribution. Think about that. That's another common sense principle. Could you have some kind of claim for indemnification in a commercial setting involving economic damages? Sure. Because parties can agree to that by contract. They generally don't agree to contribution in legal agreements. They agree to indemnification, hold harmless provisions. Okay? For claims involving contribution, we know the effect of this provision under the general obligation law. We covered that. And then finally, the other principle which we want to just keep aware of generally, right? And this is important for all of us to remember. In case family members sometimes ask this too. Does an employee under the state of New York have a right to sue their employer for personal injury? The workers' compensation law governs this area, right? And so this is important. We're exposed to that in our textbook, and we know that there are limits on when a person may sue their employer for personal injury, and those limits are prescribed by the workers' compensation law. And in the revised provision of the workers' compensation law, which appears in the book, we know it is generally when the worker suffers a severe injury. Right? So, let me qualify. I'm screwing this up a little bit. The employer is not subject to a claim for contribution. I'm talking about in terms of the employee. The employer is not subject to a claim for contribution from any of the other potential defendants unless it is what is considered to be a grave injury. Okay? And I think it's the first case talks about the amendment of the workers' compensation law. Okay, an employee can never sue the employer. But let's talk about the first case and it'll illustrate this principle. Okay? This is a lot. This is a lot to keep in mind. If I were to ask you a question on an exam, it would have to do with general principles. Okay? I'm not going to give you any tricky arithmetic. We're going to play around with the numbers. We're not going to do that. Okay? The last case in this chapter is reasonably tricky, and you actually have to write it all out in order to even understand it. Because there's a lot of numbers thrown at you in the last case in this chapter. Okay? Let's talk about the first case and what the function of the first case is so we even understand it. Why do we even bother to study Dole versus Dow Chemical? Why bother? This is a 1972 case decided by the Court of Appeals, right? This is one of those historical cases, right? This is one of those historical cases. It's here really because the textbook author thinks you should read it to have a well-rounded education. Do you need to read this case? No. You really don't. Okay, you could skip this and survive and understand what the present day law is concerning contribution pretty well based upon what we just discussed. But the author thinks you should be exposed to this, and we will cover it quickly. Okay? There's no sense getting bogged down in this case. It'll illustrate some general principles that we can apply some of our definitions. First, in order to understand the case, let's do the caption. Contemporary law, okay, I don't think it's necessary for us to look at all of the history here, but we'll talk about generally what this case stands for. But first, let's get our caption down. Who is our plaintiff? It's an individual named Dole. Dole, for our purposes, is an individual. Dole is significantly an employee. So we're going to indicate that Dole is employee. Dole sues Dow. What is Dow? Dow is the manufacturer of a chemical. It's an insecticide, right? Some kind of insecticide. Dow commences a third-party action, or, right, impleads the milling company. Doesn't have to be the name, we're just using it as a place marker. The milling company is the employer of Dole. All right. Everybody okay? This is where we are. Let's walk through this case based upon the principles that you took down a moment ago. Under New York's workers' compensation law, can Dole employees sue the milling company? Answer, no. Can any party get contribution from milling company based upon the workers' compensation law? No, except in a situation involving a grave injury. And we would have to look at the workers' compensation law to determine whether or not the injury here fell into one of the categories that would allow a party to get contribution from milling company. Right? We know from reading the text, and this is the reason that I do not like cases like this, is that the law that is reflected in this case was changed. Right? Was changed. So we're looking at 1972 law. We are not looking at the current workers' compensation law. Okay? What does this case stand for our purposes? For our purposes, this case did away, right, with a very interesting principle under the law of contribution, circa 1972. Okay? In order to understand it, I'm going to walk you through it. I do not suggest you take this down in your notes. It is not necessary. It will only confuse you. Of course, it's okay if you do. Okay? This case, procedurally, what happened in this case? Procedurally, what happened? Well, this is interesting. Dow, right, impleads the employer. Procedurally, what happened was employer made a motion to dismiss this. Under the then existing law relating to contribution, Milling Company argued, you can't get contribution from us because the present contribution law, circa 1972, did not permit it. You were actively negligent. And we see in this case this concept of active negligence, passive negligence, right? And so, Milling Company says, you were actively negligent here. You can't get contribution from us. What does the court say? The court tosses this idea, this distinction between passive, active, and says, you know what, you were both actively negligent. This idea of trying to find the degrees of active negligence versus passivity on some kind of continuum, we're going to toss this. You're both actively negligent. And really, we believe that under modern principles of contribution, Dow should be able to get contribution from you. Right? And so the principle that the court enunciates at the conclusion of the case is very simple. Joint, actively negligent tortfeasors may seek contribution among themselves in proportion to their respective fault. And all I just did basically was restate the modern rule of contribution, the definition of contribution. Right? That's procedurally how this came up, and that is the outcome. The law changed. The Court of Appeals said, Milling Company, the law of contribution that you're relying on to get out of this case is going to be tossed. We are going to devise a new system related to contribution. And from now on, joint, actively negligent tortfeasors may seek contribution among themselves. And therefore, the motion is denied. Okay? I don't want to spend any more time on this case. It's not that useful for you. It's a groundbreaking case in 1972. We move on. The next case shows the evolution of this rule. Right? Shows the evolution of this rule. And this can be somewhat confusing. I'm going to erase this caption. I'm going to put up a new caption. And again, now the court, this is another Court of Appeals decision, is re-examining age-old principles under the common law. Right? Dole has been decided. A new day has dawned with respect to the law of contribution. Now this case comes up. And this case is called E. Ambrosio v. City of New York. And there is a principle under the common law. And now the Court of Appeals is looking at this and saying, I think it's the Court of Appeals, let's double check. Yeah, Court of Appeals, 1982, 10 years later, is looking at this and saying, does this old common law principle that New York City is relying on to get out of the case, does it still apply in the post-Dole world? Right? And what does the court say? Let's first get a caption up. We have plaintiff accident. I'm going to call this plaintiff. We legitimately use the term employee. This is just, this is slip and fall, so this is just, we're just going to use called accident victim. This is NYC. accident victim sues defendant landowner. Defendant landowner makes a cross-claim contribution or brings in the city, and the city makes a motion to dismiss on the grounds that there is something called a special benefit rule. Let's back up a second. Okay. Plaintiff, walking down the street, trips on an obstruction that's built into the sidewalk. Turns out this little obstruction on the sidewalk was some kind of raised area which related to an improvement that was made by the city on behalf of the landowner. Okay? There's a little, I don't recall exactly, my notes may indicate what it was. It was a metal disc that covered a water shut-off valve that was embedded in the sidewalk. Okay? And the water shut-off valve had been installed for the benefit of the landowner. Under normal negligence principles, the city is responsible for maintaining the sidewalk. So the city can't get out of that responsibility. Normally, absolutely responsible for the sidewalk, non-delegable. Also, plaintiff landowner, defendant landowner was also responsible for maintaining sidewalk. What happens in the case is that the city says, well, there is an old common law doctrine called the special benefit rule. We, the city, installed this for the benefit of the landowner. Really, the landowner should reimburse us for this. To the extent that we're held liable, we are entitled to indemnification. Okay. Under this common law principle. The court looks at this, and again, this is another historical case, right? Looks at this and says, well, common law indemnification. Common law indemnification is usually or should be available where you have, right, a party who is basically blameless, but is nevertheless, as a matter of law, responsible to the accident victim. Right? This concept of being blameless comes up where we're talking about this common law indemnification. Okay? And then the court does what? The court says, well, is this a situation where the city is really blameless, and but for the negligence of the landowner, the city would be off the hook? And what does the court conclude? The court concludes, no, this is not such a situation. This common law principle is shifting the responsibility, which the city absolutely has a duty to its citizens to maintain its property, maintain the city's common areas like the sidewalk, right? The city is not blameless. This smacks of the same thing the Court of Appeals was trying to eradicate through Dole. These are two, right, to quote Dole, actively negligent tortfeasors. They're both actively negligent. Both of them have a duty to make sure that the sidewalk is safe. And, no, and as a result, contribution should apply here. And the common law principle, the special benefit rule, which permitted indemnification, in this instance anyway, and perhaps permanently, we're not told, no good. That defense does not apply here in the post-Dole world. Now, how does this case help you? I don't really think that it does help you. I don't think that it does. I don't think it adds anything to the principles that we've talked about. Okay? Okay? One thing it does bring up for our benefit, and you really have to think hard about this, because I don't think it's so obvious, is the idea that that indemnification, at least in the minds of the judges who are on the Court of Appeals, is really something that should apply when a defendant is blameless. We're going to see this again in that next-to-last case, right? If someone is actively negligent, you don't get the benefit of common law indemnification, and the court says, well, you're actively negligent. You had a duty. You breached it. You can't get common law indemnification. You can't push that off onto the landowner. Okay? Rainbow versus Rogatnik. Rainbow, unfortunately for you, is another case, this is on page 472, where I'm going to sketch out the facts quickly, but there are three principles that we have to pull out of this case. Right? Three principles. This introduces us to some new ideas, not previously covered in all of the discussion that we've had so far. It's hard to believe, but this area is a big area. What is the Rainbow case about? The Rainbow case basically introduces us to three principles. One of which is sort of common sense based upon what we've talked about. The other two are not. Okay? We'll get through this quickly and then you won't be tormented by this anymore. This case talks about a situation where two or more tort feasors act together to produce an injury. Right? That's the first fact scenario that's discussed by the court. Or it's the first one that I'm going to say that the court discusses. Two or more tort feasors act concurrently to produce an injury. Where you have that scenario, okay, those tort feasors may be held jointly and severally liable. They are considered to be joint tort feasors. So it gives us a definition of what a joint tortfeasor. What is a joint tortfeasor? All right. Then the case introduces another idea. Where you have multiple tortfeasors, two or more, but they do not act in concert, they do not contribute concurrently to the same wrong. Okay? Each of them may produce an injury, right? But they are separate injuries. Okay? They produce independent and successive injuries. Each party is liable for the separate injury their conduct caused. Right? Two or more people act together to produce an injury. They're jointly liable. Each one of them can be liable for the one or both. Right? That makes sense. This other principle makes sense too. Right? Where you have, and the second one is a little bit easier to think of in my mind anyway, in terms of an automobile accident. Party A smashes, and I think the text mentions it, I don't remember what it's called. Party A smashes into the car. As a result, or as part of it, Party B smashes into the car. Right? We have this automobile is struck here by A, and another car strikes as a result. Okay. Set aside the idea that but for A's collision, there wouldn't have been a collision with involving B. But at least here we can separate the injuries. A hit the rear of the car, B hit the front of the car. Independent successive injuries, we can attach a numerical dollar value to the damage caused by each tort feasor. Independent successive injuries. Okay. Separate concept. Easy to understand. What is the Rabo versus Rogatnik case about? right? This case is about a third principle, right? Very simple case. You have a situation where you have two positions. Each one, in theory, contributed to an injury. But they didn't do it concurrently, right? We had a physician who was involved in delivering a baby and caused injury. We had a physician who was responsible for the care of the child after its birth, caused injury. Right? In theory, they should have been independent, successive tort cases. What does the court say? The court says there is a third rule. The court says that when an injury is indivisible, okay? Indivisible. And it produces a single, basically inseparable injury. All tortfeasors are jointly and severally liable. That's what this case is about. And that's basically it. This chapter is so busy. It's got so many different principles. But that's what this is about, right? What winds up happening is that we have doctor number two here who is responsible for the care of an infant. His allocable share of the injury is said to be 20% for purposes of contribution. Right? His problem is he's jointly and severally liable, so he may have to pay the entire contribution from the 80% person. So he's saying, I don't understand. How can I be jointly and severally liable? The jury decided that I'm only 20% liable. And the court says, yeah, you know, the 20% relates to your contribution. In this particular case, okay, the jury did not find that you produced, that there was an independent, separable injury caused by you. There is one overall verdict relating to the both of you, because the jury couldn't figure out, as between the two of you, which produced what. But if it took the purpose of contribution, you're 20% liable. That's your share. But you're both jointly and separately liable. We do not have a situation here where we have two separate, severable, independent injuries with separate dollar figures attached, where A can be liable for no more than 5, and B can be liable for no more than 10. In this case, there is one judgment. You're both jointly and severally liable. Yes, it flies in the face of the idea that you were each involved with the care of this child at different times. Yes, that's true. But this is an exception. The injury which you both contributed to is indivisible. We can't divide it up. That's all this case is about. Tell us about an exception to these rules. Okay? I do not think these cases are that easy. I think that they are tricky, and there are a ton of principles floating around. Not an easy area. Personal injury area, this is, you know, not an easy area. I do this all the time. Let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll finish. Three cases left. Okay, we'll finish these three cases and we'll see if we can talk a little bit about motions that will be done with this. Thank you.
spoke about this word 50%, or they just lie over their percentage of the farm. Well, how would you figure it out?
What happened was, each one of them, his beef was, he didn't want to be responsible for paying full judgment. And his the concept was, and this is, I don't think it's that clear in the case, but the idea was he was saying, look, I had nothing to do with what this other guy did. I cared for this child. I wasn't involved in the delivery that led to an injury. The jury has decided I'm only 20% liable. You, the court, can't expect me to pay more than 20%. The jury has made a decision. The judge says, no, you don't understand. You are both equally responsible for paying the entire judgment. And he's saying, how can that be? I wasn't... The harm which was produced was not concurrent. We didn't work together. We didn't work at the same time. And the court says, well, yes, but this is an unusual situation. And this injury is basically indivisible. There was no testimony which would have enabled the jury to separate out the harm that each of you caused.
They couldn't have made the 28 distinction because it should be 50-50. And there's three would be 30-30. Right. But that's just a myth. Like, what you is as jointly severally liable?
If they're jointly and severally liable, they're all equally responsible for paying the whole. Right? Now, he would pay the whole, then he would sue to get back 80% from the other guy. Yeah.
But then there's the thing that they can't know which injury is what.
Well,
it's determined as one invisible injury, so you can't tell. That what percentage
was. Yeah.
So otherwise, not in this exception, if you just draw things and really pay the whole and then sue for contribution.
Correct. Or, see, it gets a little confusing because as the author says, when you have this joint several and you have multiple people involved, they can each pay their share up front. Or what can happen is one can pay more than their share and then sue the others to try and get repay the excess that the one you gave. Okay. the first matrimonial attorney, Attorney Joyce, saying, among other things, hey, wait a minute, I lost out on this maintenance between the period of December 75, when I hired you, and November of 77. Okay? Sound familiar? That's what happens in this case. So, Shower has a malpractice claim against her first attorney, who she fired, and she says, you know, because of your having dropped out of the case, the way you handled it, I lost out on this maintenance from December of 75 to November of 77. Okay, let's pause for a second. Attorney Joyce impleads Attorney Chance. And it's interesting, right? Joyce impleads Attorney Gent and says, you know, you picked up this case after I had it, and really, but for your negligent representation of Shower, you should have gotten maintenance dating back to December of 75. So you screwed up. You contributed to this problem. You should have fixed this problem. It was fixable. It was something that you could have addressed when you were representing Shower. You should have taken care of this. I want contribution from you for causing this injury. Okay? What does Jen say to Attorney Joyce in response to this argument? Attorney Gent makes the following argument, and you know, it's not a bad argument when you think about it. Nor is the rejoinder, by the way, but I mean, Attorney Gent's argument doesn't sound too bad either. Attorney Gent says, hey, wait a second. My client was Shower. Shower did not sue me. You have no privity of contract with me. I was never retained by you. I had no relationship, attorney-client relationship with you. How can you sue me for contribution? Right? That's the argument that Jen makes. And you know, that makes a certain amount of sense. What does the court say? The court says, Attorney Jen, you got it all wrong. What's happening here? Okay. The issue is not whether you, Attorney Jen, owe a duty to the first lawyer. You're missing the point. Although I gotta say, I might have made the same argument, but the court is saying that you're missing the point, Attorney Jen. Each of you owed a duty to Shower. Okay? Each of you owed a duty to the plaintiff. Okay? To the extent that you, Gent, breached that duty, you also contributed to this injury. So you owed a duty to her just like I did. And to the extent that you failed to do everything that you were supposed to do as her attorney, you contributed to this injury. Therefore, right, contribution is possible in this case. Because contribution applies to joint tortfeasors, right, concurrent tortfeasors, successive tortfeasors, independent tortfeasors, intentional tortfeasors, and alternative tortfeasors. You want to say tortfeasors or something. Tortfeasors. Okay? So this case gives us just a little bit more insight into the nature of contribution. Right? when we think of contribution, right, among parties who have contributed to a personal injury, do we think about them having duties to one another? Sometimes we do, but not necessarily, right? Not necessarily. And it's the same here. There wasn't necessarily any relationship between Jen and Joyce. There really wasn't. There was no relationship. But each of them had in common the fact that they had a duty to the plaintiff, and as a result of a breach of that duty that they owed to the plaintiff, in theory anyway, at this stage of the case, each of them contributed to this injury. Okay?
I'm sorry, what was the last time you did a connection in that list?
Intentional.
Joint, concurrent, successive, independent, and intentional?
Independent, alternative, and intentional.
Thank you.
Okay? Everybody okay with this case then? That's the idea. This gives us a little bit more of an explanation about the concept, the underpinnings of contribution. Okay? And I have to say that I could easily have been seduced by this argument that Jen made. Not a bad argument. But, you know, on further reflection, I understand what the court is saying. All right. Rosado versus Proctor and Schwartz. Cover this case quickly. Rosado is the employee. Right? We have to keep these parties straight in these cases. Employer. Okay? We know that it would have had to cause a grave injury under the workers' comp law for Proctor to successfully maintain an action against Comet. Okay? For contribution. Okay? We set aside whether this is a sufficiently grave injury for the moment. This case actually involves, right, for our purposes, the issue under this case arises under the general obligation law relating to settlements. Okay, that's why this case is here. It's to show us something about settlements. Now, let's go back to the general obligation law. But first, I have to tell you what happened in the case, right? Just to remind you, again, this is another one of these cases that it's easy on. If you don't read this thing really carefully, you could miss what the issues were and what was really happening. What happens? Rosado is injured by using a machine. For your purposes, the key to this case, right, is that Proctor and Comet both settled with Rosado. Right? Both of them settled. Now, go back to the general obligation law. When you have a party that settles with a personal injury plaintiff, can co-defendants get contribution from that party, the settling party? Answer, no. Right? So, Procter, the manufacturer, settles with the employees. So how the heck can Procter sue Conic? Once this occurs, how can Procter continue to maintain an action against Conic? Because there's a little quirk, right? There's an exception. Procter makes a claim for indemnification against Conic. Does Procter have a contract with Conic which allows it to assert a contractual indemnification claim? Answer? It does not. The contract between Procter and Conic, in this case, Procter manufactured a machine and sold it to Conic, this contract does not contain an indemnification provision. It does not. So, that leaves us with only one doctrine, right? For Procter to maintain some kind of indemnification claim against Conic, it has to be relying on some kind of implied indemnity. Right? Some kind of implied indemnity. And we know that where we have a contract, a written agreement between Procter and Conic, a written agreement, right? That's going to trigger contract law in our minds. It's got to be some kooky doctrine that Procter is relying on that is going to fall outside the scope of the written agreement and give some kind of indemnification right. Correct? Would you guys all agree with that? How, right, between two parties that are parties to a written agreement, how can Procter raise some kind of wacky doctrine outside the four corners of the agreement since their contract does not have an indemnification provision? Right off the bat, you know this has got to be a stupid claim. And it is, right? It's a stupid claim. I mean, the court addresses it pretty thoroughly, but it's basically a stupid claim. The claim is this. Procter, as the manufacturer, says, I have a contract with you. My contract requires you to install safety guards. Because you breach that duty, I have a right to indemnification. It says, among other things, that it was passively liable. Really didn't do anything wrong. All of the blame should be put on Conic. And what does the court say about that? The court says this is a, it doesn't say it quite concerns, but the court says this is a silly argument. You've introduced an unreasonably dangerous product into the stream of commerce. How can you say you had no responsibility? You are not supposed to be selling unreasonably dangerous products, and you have a non-delegable duty. Right? A non-delegable duty. You can't just ship that to your buyer. You are not supposed to sell unreasonably dangerous products and then try and get out of it by saying it's somebody else's job to install safety equipment. So the court thoroughly rejects, on other grounds as well, the idea that there is some kind of implied indemnification. That doesn't fly at all. Okay? But it does introduce us to this idea, right? It does introduce us to this idea that a settling party has no claim for contribution, but could still have a claim for indemnification. In this case, it was a lousy indemnification claim. This is basically a stupid indemnification claim. But the court does not reject it as a matter of law, saying there is no right to indemnification. It says, in this case, you didn't make out your claim for indemnification. Okay? All right. That brings us to the last case of the evening. Sometimes I teach this case. Sometimes I don't. Tonight, I'll go through it quickly. There's no way to teach this place, without putting the numbers on the board. It's really simple when you put the numbers on the board. The reason for teaching this case, if there is a reason, is because it ties into the first subsection of the general obligation law, letter A, which we didn't read aloud because it's really complicated. This is a good time to read it aloud, but first let's talk about the facts. Okay? I wouldn't say it's fun to run the numbers, but it's interesting. And the argument that the lawyer made in this case is pretty interesting. We'll run through this quickly and then you guys can head out, okay? Now, again, there's no way you can figure this case out if you haven't meticulously written everything down on a piece of paper. Trust me, it's impossible. Unless you can really carry all these numbers around in your head. The verdict is $5.8 million reduced to $3.9 million. Okay? And there were basically three litigants that the court identifies. Keene, jury said 15% responsible, did not settle. Manville, 60% responsible. A group of others, smaller players, 25% responsible. Now, don't look at the numbers that they settled for. Okay? 60% of 3.9 mil is more than a half of this rate. So it's roughly 2 mil. Right? What did Manville pay? Manville settled for $800,000. Right? What's 25% of 4 mil? 500,000. Right? What did the others settle for? 2.5 mil. These were the actual amounts that they paid. Now, what's the lesson here? Forget the formulas in the case. Right? You know the old saying, you pay your money and you take your chances, right? You don't know in these cases how things are going to turn out. So this case is kind of interesting right off the bat without even applying any of these formulas. Because you can see, Manville got out of this case cheap. Paid a fraction of what it would have been responsible for. Good reason to settle, right? The others, this collectivity, I'm going to guess that they all chipped in, right? That's who the others are, the plural others. They all chipped in, and they probably made individual contributions that were not that significant, really. I mean, they could have, we're going to make up some things here, which we don't know for sure. But let's say it's five of them, and they each chipped in $500,000. They probably thought, well, we're only paying $500,000. There was a big potential for liability compared to three. You know what? That's not a lot. You know what I'm saying? And that could have been the rationale. Anyway, in the aggregate, they contributed $2.5 mil. They're only 25% liable. they could have gotten out of this case with less money, but it's a chance. Keene did not settle. 15% liable. Now, this case is just designed to show you how this crazy formula works. What is the most that Keene can be liable for? 15% to $3.9 million, right? It can't be liable for more. It can't be liable for more. It can settle for more. It can settle for less, right? But the most it can be liable for is the 15% of the 3.9. Right? Can't be liable for more. But here's where the formula kicks in, right? The formula under letter A, let's read it for a second. This is a good time to read it. And it is, you know, it's not so easy to understand this formula. It says basically, when a release, I'm going to paraphrase it, when a release is given to two or more persons who are liable in tort for the same injury, it doesn't discharge any of the other tort pieces from liability. All right, so Keene is still liable. We know that. We would know that as a matter of common sense. But it reduces the claim that the plaintiff has against the non-settling tortfeasor. Please bear in mind, guys, I'm paraphrasing, so this thing is easier to understand. It reduces the claim against the non-settling tortfeasor to the extent of any amount stipulated by the release or the amount of consideration that was actually paid. Or the amount of the released tortfeasor's equitable share of the damages under Article 14 of the CPLR. Whichever is greatest. Okay? So, this number can only go down, right? This number can go down. It can never be more, but it can go down depending upon what they actually pay. These guys can get some credit against their liability depending upon what the settling parties pay. What did the settling parties pay? The total that the settling parties paid was $3.3 million. If you took the 15% share of the $3.9 million, this is what they would be responsible for, $585. The settling parties paid $3.3 million. That would yield $600,000. They can't be liable for more than the 15. So the payments, which they got credit for, which would have been compared, which are part of the comparison here, didn't help them. Didn't actually reduce the amount. So they wound up being liable for $585. Okay? Take a look. These are the two formulas. Okay? If you took a look at the 15% of the 3.9 mil, it yields 585. But we can also compare this number to the cash that the plaintiff actually received. Okay? If the plaintiff had gotten paid, say, 3.5 mil in total, right? That would have left 400K unpaid. These guys could have gotten away with paying only $400K. Remember, that's a risk that the plaintiff takes, right? The plaintiff can settle for less. Right? this is how the formulas work. You get credit for, right? This works inures to the benefit of the non-settling party is gambling, right? That's what's happening. The non-settling party is gambling, but the non-settling, because the non-settling party doesn't know what this percentage is going to be. The effect of this is to make sure that the plaintiff does not get more than the 3.9 million. That's the most the plaintiff can get. And the non-settling party takes a chance. Well, that's not actually correct. The non-settling party could get more than the 3.9 million at the end of the day. They paid more. No, the most is the 3.9. Okay, does this make sense? Is this reasonably clear? Now, I'm not going to complicate this by explaining what the argument was that Keene made. I'm just going to describe the argument that Keene made. Keene said, you know, Judge, really, you see this total dollar value or percentage of fall? What Keene did was play around with the formulas. Keene said, let's apply the total dollar value or percentage of fall to the others. And let's apply the total value of payments. Whoops, strike that. Keene said, percentage formula here. Dollar value of payments here. Keene wanted to mix up the two formulas, combine them, cherry pick, to see, well, as to Manville, we're going to choose one formula, and as to the others, we're going to choose a different formula. And when you combine them, it's going to work to Keene's benefit. And the court said, no, you've got a choice. It's either this formula or this formula. And you apply it straight across. But you can't choose between them and play around with them and manipulate it so that you can come up with some other number. I'm not sure whether I'm describing this clearly. I have it all written on a sheet of paper. I'm not going to go through it. This is how it actually works out. Okay? That's it. Next week we'll make faster progress. You guys will not have problems understanding motions, orders to show cause, and so on. We'll go through it, and we'll start talking about substantive motions. And that'll be interesting. That'll be more interesting than this. It won't be so esoteric, and it'll be more practical.
Right.
This went down below 585.
Yeah.
Would have got the benefit.
It would have done.
Yeah.
So that's the risk you take.
That's the risk.
You might get a benefit or you might have to pay your full share.
Exactly. Exactly. You can never be responsible for more than your full share.
So those are the formula that we have done.
Yep. Yep. And then you turn the corner, you see the other one.
No shame. Everybody's secret. It's what a lot of it.
Right? And then you get to give it to them. They're weak.
And they find where it's safe.
The court tells us in that case that it's for the benefit of the defendants for whacking up who pays what in terms of deciding what the contribution plan is. Even though either one of them
is
the uncomfortable person. Right.
It's a matter
of the court tells us not a matter of the plaintiffs.
Right.
It has no effect on what the plaintiff gets out of that. Because each one of them is responsible for the amount of the plaintiff.
It just comes to another order to have no
effect. Right. But remember, what we won't do is my work on my But it could also be the party was in the middle of the court. And then I have to pursue the other.
Yeah.